This lecture is entitled LSD and the Art of Conscious Living. And tonight I am acting the role of Richard Alpert. I'm so used to starting these meetings that I've been holding on the West Coast with a legal disclaimer that rather than break a very adaptive habit, let me start by saying that nothing I will say tonight should in any way be interpreted as my advocating the overthrow of the United States government by force or violence. A few weeks ago, there was an article in Life magazine called Guru Goes to Kansas. And I hope many of you saw it. It was an article that demonstrated that life actually can be beautiful. It concerned Allen Ginsberg. And I would like to put in my bit here, as every other speaker, as many of the other speakers have, as a member of the advisory committee. Yes, sir. As a member of the advisory committee, I was a little concerned that none of us were consulted about dropping Allen from the program. And I think that there is a certain humor in the fact that the University of California didn't consider him a sufficient expert to participate in this conference. And during these few days, he has been, as I understand it, in Washington testifying before the Dodd Committee as an expert in the matter of psychedelics. Now, I'm proud to be at a university that sets itself above the United States Senate. Talk louder, please. How about that? Okay. I originally had planned to speak about the place of transcendental experiences, or that is, the transcending of the ego, in current science. And I had planned to discuss adaptations that were necessary. And I was going to talk about reality and some of the major quests of man. And then Friday night, I was at the bookstore and I bought a book, which when I read it, I found it had said everything I wanted to say. So rather than make believe I haven't read it, I decided to change my speech and merely recommend to you that you all read the book, because it comes from Abraham Maslow, and better it should come from him than me. The book is called Religions, Values, and Peak Experience. It's a lecture, the Kappa Delta Pi lecture series, and it's Ohio University Press, and I strongly urge that you all read this book. Religions, Values, and Peak Experiences. And he poses in there a series of questions, which are the basic questions, which you can divide into any number you want, but he characterized them very well. And they seem to be the questions to which the psychedelic experience and the way in which it changes your life are directed. And I thought I might just review briefly by reading to you Abe Maslow's list. He says you can consider these spiritual, philosophical, religious, humanistic, or ethical questions. What is the good life? What is the good man? The good woman? What is the good society and what is my relation to it? What are my obligations to society? What is best for my children? What is justice, truth, virtue? What is my relation to nature, to death, to aging, to pain, to illness? How can I live a zestful, enjoyable, meaningful life? What is my responsibility to my brothers? Who are my brothers? What shall I be loyal to? What must I be ready to die for? Now, tonight, I am primarily concerned with social institutions that we can conceive of that will help us realize some of the effects of psychedelic experiences. Now, I am not completely out of contact with reality, and I am therefore still aware of the legal and political hysteria which is surrounding the psychedelic issue. The ill-advised and irresponsible action of the California legislature, going against the advice of their own research staff and the guidelines laid down by the federal government, the present training course of the FDA, in which guns are being issued to the agents to deal with us, Goddard, head of the Food and Drug Administration, Dr. Goddard, yesterday in the newspaper, calling consciousness expansion as a product of psychedelics, quote, sheer bunk, unquote. Now, I might get quite concerned about all of this, but the other day I was with a friend of mine who used to be a pusher. Now, he only sold psychedelics at very low prices, and it was very good quality, and he sold it to people he loved, because he thought that was a humanly beautiful thing to do. And then when things got a little hot, he decided to go out of business, and I was asking him whether or not this was a hardship on him to go out of business, and he said, no, it was fascinating, because he realized that as most of the people like him would stop selling chemicals, the mafia would move in. And he knew that sooner or later they would test the product. And what fascinated him, as it fascinates me, now, in discussing these social institutions, the issue that this situation in the government is raising concerns the interface between any kind of institution you could set up and the society in which that institution must function. And in the past few years, I've been identified with some institutions for which there has been some tension in the interface, in Mexico, in Millbrook, and then I have spent time with Ken Kesey and the Hell's Angels, and all of these are involved in social institutions with which there is some tension between the institution and the larger society. Now, what is being created by present legislation is merely intensifying, as far as I can see, the tension that exists within this interface. And I have suggested, along with colleagues, some alternatives to the government's present position. One of them, which a number of us have been suggesting, is that the government use the limited licensing which it uses for radioisotopes to set up centers which can be privately financed, government controlled, where any responsible citizen could come and have a psychedelic experience for whatever reason he might choose. This would be allowing maximum freedom and yet some control and protection. It is now clear to me that well over 70% of the people who use psychedelics are not the least bit interested in being criminals. They are not feeling rebellious towards society. And they would welcome any reasonable alternative to the one that is currently being proposed, which is control out of existence for most of all of us. In a book that is coming out the day after tomorrow, in which I collaboratively non-collaborated with Sidney Cohen, I suggested in there that I wrote an open letter to the head of the Health, Education, and Welfare, Secretary Gardner, in which I suggested that they set up an agency similar to the FAA, the Federal Aviation Agency, and that they call the agency the Internal Flight Agency, or IF Agency, and that the agency license people over 16 years of age who could successfully demonstrate that they could indeed take off and land safely. And the pilot's license you would get would allow you only to fly with other licensed pilots. It would be much later that you would get a solo license. And that in addition, the IF agency would provide ground control centers that you could call into if you needed help, if you got lost in the clouds. And furthermore, it would provide maps and charts for special journeys you might like to take. Now, when you think about it, there are a lot of planes sitting out at the airport, and we don't all go out and jump into them and fly away just for fun. We're all perfectly willing to go out and get licensed when we want to fly. And it isn't as unrealistic as it may sound at first glance. Los Angeles CBS just called and they said, did we hear in your news conference that you said there should be an agency like the Federal Aviation Agency? So I gave him a statement, and at the end he says, well, if that's what you want to say. There's nothing much to lose anymore, you know. Now we can say, all right, taking the society as it presently exists, what kind of social institutions do and don't and could exist that we would be interested in? Now let me give you an example of one I tried to develop that didn't work. It couldn't exist, apparently. A while back here in Los Angeles, there was a Dr. Gary Fisher who was working in the back ward of a hospital with autistic children. Not artistic children, autistic children. These are children who, at the earliest stages of their development, somehow have failed to relate to the outside world. So the result is that nothing that comes in from the outside alters their thought process, so they don't learn anything. They're turned off to the outside world, if you will, by a very early learning experience. There's nothing organically wrong with them. Now, Dr. Fisher invited us to sit in on one of his sessions, and we came in near the end of it. This was a session in a back room, in a room in the hospital. It had been fixed up. It had drapes and carpets. Tchaikovsky was playing on the record player. There was a medical student who was a sitter during the day, and he was holding the child. And this was a 9-year-old child who had been administered LSD earlier in the day. Now, I've worked as a child psychologist for a number of years, and I've seen many autistic children. And you could go right onto the back ward there and see them, and you could see the way in which they related to the environment. This child under LSD in this setting had a look of complete and open wonder in his eyes. And if ever I had seen anybody turned on to the world, it was that child. Now, the unfortunate situation there was that at the end of the session, the child was sent back into the ward. And those of you that have had psychedelic sessions can imagine what that all must be like. Now, the reason I bring this up, there is some research going on in New York with autistic children, but in this case, they give them LSD as if they were giving them penicillin. There is no attempt to deal with a psychological setting for the child. Now, the reason this interests me is because of a theory we've been playing with for a long time that concerns primarily animal research. And for many of you that have heard this, this is just a quick review. It concerns imprinting. In animal research, there are stages in development during which an animal seems to be very open to certain kinds of stimuli out in the environment. And if these stimuli occur, he makes a built-in response. If during these critical periods, they're called, the stimulus doesn't occur in the environment, he never makes the appropriate response. For example, with sheep, if you separate lamb from the flock during a critical period, then when that period is passed, if you bring the sheep in with the rest of the sheep, he will hang out alone rather than with the other sheep. And sheep hang out together, so he becomes a unique sheep in the group. This is an example of failure, if you will, to imprint the group during a critical period of his development. Well, now, if you apply this metaphor, and consider it only a metaphor, to human development, you could argue that at different stages in our development, different months, there are different critical periods during which time we are open to different kinds of experiences. This fits in, by the way, with the Freudian model of psychosexual stages of development and so on. Now, the reason further that I'm interested in this is because I'd noticed that even though all of us have had hundreds of sessions together, and each of us have even had many hundreds, I could still recognize all the people in the group. Certainly many of our characteristics were different, but Tim was still Tim, and Carol was still Carol, and Jane was Jane, and so on. And I was curious what the depths of the LSD experience were all about. And it seemed to me that what had happened was that we could deal very easily with the superficial personality characteristics and behaviors and the philosophical insights, but some of the core personality characteristics didn't seem to be open to our investigation, and I felt it was primarily because we didn't know how to program sessions to explore those areas. Then I realized why we don't know much about core personality is because everybody has one. It's like a Ford assembly line. All the Fords come out, so you never even know how it works because they all look the same. But autistic children are the one group where it goes wrong right at the beginning. And it stood to reason that if we could take these autistic children and indeed explore with them through LSD, we might indeed learn something about this initial laying down of core personality concepts. Well, I wanted to correct for Gary Fisher's problem, and so I designed a study which would be run out at a country estate with doctors and so on, and we would have two rooms so that the child would move from the room he started in through the session into a whole new setting after the session. He'd be out with trees and rocks and water and so on. And I presented this in great detail through a number of medical and doctorate, PhD people to the state of Connecticut. And 7 months went by, and I had a number of letters from the President's Commission on Mental Retardation. And finally, I got turned down. And the reason I got turned down was the inside statement, well, fluoridation is a hot issue for us this year, and we can't risk two hot political issues in one year. Now, you can all that know NIMH be reasonably assured that NIMH would not sponsor such a project either. So this is an example, if you will, of a type of study which cannot be done at this moment in this kind of a relaxed, loose setting because of the panic concerning LSD and the need for close institutional linkage. There is another institution I mentioned briefly which can't exist, although we are, various of us are trying, and this concerns a setting up a telephone emergency call service. Now, one of us has indeed been trying to do this, but I point out to her as well as to myself when we all thought about it, that if you were to list the telephone number in Los Angeles and say, anybody that's in trouble, call this number and we'll send a sitter over to be with you. This is a human service to be provided. The reaction of the government would be to tap the phone and arrest the people that would call. So here again is another social institution that we would like to set up that existing legislation does not allow a natural process to occur that would otherwise occur. Now, let me shift to a second institution which is emerging in spite of everything. In 1965, we wrote up a model that was suggested a year earlier by Dr. Metzner, a model for a discotheque, for a discotheque church, for a rock and roll spiritual endeavor. In our search, this is from the brochure, in our search for collaborative psychedelic game, we have evaluated various possibilities in terms of the following criteria. Can the game be designed to remain fluid? Will the game raise the ecstasy level of the participants? Will the game involve an honest and open contract with society? Will the game be legally and financially sound? We have considered a variety of models mindful of the above criteria. We have chosen this new vehicle after careful assessment. As you well know, rock and roll and other strongly rhythmical folk music in its various guises provides an expanding segment of the population its musical diet. Moreover, it is demonstrable that this same music in its electrical nature is capable of turning on large groups of people. See Time magazine's Everybody's Turned On. And if they say it, that's... People of diverse ages and backgrounds find a common denominator in this music, which enables them to transcend their individual realities and join in group dance and group song. Long the function of music in tribal and traditional societies. Viewing this phenomenon from a spiritual viewpoint, we observe the relationship both in form and content with certain modes of religious music which have been created for the objective purpose of causing the dancer listener to transcend himself through involvement with rhythms which are related to physiological phenomena, such as heartbeat, the electrical phenomena of the autonomic nervous system, pulse, rate, breath, etc. Now, we had no sooner gotten the idea on the drawing board, we were obviously part of the zeitgeist, because Ken Kesey, very shortly thereafter, started to appear with what were called his acid tests. Now, the acid test, when you read about it in the Los Angeles Times, or in some of the other papers, San Jose Mercury, really sounded pretty scary. Here were a group of unknowing people coming to a dance hall, and LSD was being put in the lemonade, and people were having sessions in this large group scene. Now, I went to some of the acid tests, and in fact, I don't think there were very many people, in fact, I don't think there were hardly any at the ones I was at, that ever ingested any chemical that they didn't expect they were going to ingest. And I would say that of all of the group religious experiences I have ever been at, when some of the group snake dances were going on in the midst of these acid tests with a very powerful primitive beat and the feelings, or what I now call in my more far-out state, the vibrations, being so intense, I was awed that people in the age range of 17 to 25 could participate and collaborate in as profound an emotional experience in as humanly loving a way as they did. What they had done and what others are doing and what you'll get a chance to see in part when Geert Stern and the USCO group have their show, is the control of the total environment, the auditory and visual environment, simultaneously. And when there is a group agreement to, in a sense, check one's ego at the door, the experience for many of the people, especially when it is compounded with a strobe light, for example, is a tremendously intense and powerful one. And I look at the rock and roll groups that currently exist. Now, it is a known fact to me, although probably not a publicly statistically known fact, but it is I'll make an estimate, let's not call it a fact. I will make an estimate that 85 to 90% of the current rock and roll groups use psychedelics, okay? From the top on down. And the kind of music that has been coming out of these groups, which is very interesting because it differs from jazz where the soloist improvised and it was his game. The improvisation is intensely a group experience. Just the titles of these groups, the Grateful Dead, the Lovin' Spoonfuls, just imagine that. Lovin' Spoonfuls play a song, Do You Believe in Magic? Now, in the influence of the East in rock and roll music with the sitar and the rhythms, the Eastern rhythms. And it certainly doesn't, what my suggestion is, here is a social institution right under our very noses that has come in with all of the values that come out of the psychedelic experience through all of the lyrics of these songs, through the rhythms, through the group experiences that are created around them. It's existing, it's going on, and all of the kids between 17 and 25 are hearing it. And the suggestions that are, disc jockeys have an index, like the Catholic Church. And Bob Dylan's record, Stoned, is on the index, as is a one by the Byrds. Now, it doesn't seem likely to me that any control of that nature, but you see, there it is going to change. Now, it's very interesting that the record Stoned by Bob Dylan has been ruled out, while the record Stoned by Ray Charles, Bob Dylan's record is called Rainy Day Woman, by the way. The Ray Charles version is allowed in because that's about alcohol, but it's still Let's Go Get Stoned. But it's an alcohol referent rather than clearly a psychedelic referent. If you're a devotee of rock and roll music, as I have become, you will be fascinated to notice, for example, the difference between what is the alcohol culture, which is reflected in somebody like Nancy Sinatra, and... her record, Boots Are Made for Walking, and that's what they shall do. Now, when after the Mafia, we go that whole cycle, she will be singing The Word Is Love. as I understand it. That'll probably send me to jail. Now, all right, so there, whether you've noticed it or not, is a social institution that has come right in and seems to be going right along. And now it's getting all American, and you can go to the Longshoremen's Hall and get an American version of this without the LSD, but with lights and colors and music, and people are experiencing something. Not as much as they would with acid, of course, but something. And this is cropping up in all of the major cities in the United States. Okay, now, even in this society the way it is now, I'd like to suggest a social institution which has not yet made its appearance, but will. There has been an article circulated that is going to be discussed by Dr. Cohen, an article by Eric Cast. This is the second in a series of research projects he has done in which LSD is administered to terminal cancer patients. Now, one of the unfortunate aspects of Dr. Cast's study is that it's administered to them as a painkiller with no other preparation than that. But it's still an interesting study. And when I read it in the World Medical News a few years ago, the phrase that haunted me was a quote from one of the patients in which the patient said, "I know I'm dying, but look at the beauty of the universe." Right? I know I'm dying, but look at the beauty of the universe. And that clicked in my computer with the memory of a woman whom I visited in Canada when I was speaking up there. She was close to 80, and I asked her why she was interested in LSD, because she had come to my lecture. And her answer was, "Well, the next major thing I have to do in life is to die. And I suspect that LSD may have something to do with this." Okay. That's the second bit of data I want to feed in. The third concerns Aldous Huxley's book Island, in which he gives an actual blueprint for a psychedelic death, in which the wife of the doctor experiences the dissociative moment, and the whole experience of dying is a positive, liberating one. Now, when you read that, you were amazed at how disparate it was from any known real-life experience of death you knew about in this culture, at least for me. Because almost without exception, in this culture, you are surrounded at times of death by people who deny death. Because there is a taboo about death that is much stronger than any sexual taboo you could ever imagine. So that as you're dying, people are saying you're looking better. As you're taking your last breath, you'll be up and around tomorrow. No confrontation with up where, around where, just up and around. It was in 1961 or two, I guess, Tim Leary showed me the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And it was on a Saturday, and I had had a session on a Thursday night with psilocybin. And as I leafed through this book, which was 2,500 years old, I came to a passage in the section on second bardo hallucinations, which brought me up short, because there, in very minute detail, was a description of the psychedelic experience I had had on Thursday night, and which I had described on Friday as ineffable. Okay. how could I have experienced something which was written 2,500 years earlier as a manual to prepare people to die and be reborn? Well, all of my thoughts had been anticipated by Tim and Ralph, who are already busy working on the adaptation of the Tibetan book as a psychedelic manual, the argument being that one could look at this book as an esoteric metaphor concerning psychological death and rebirth, the transcendence of the ego, or, if you will, the psychological death of you as you know yourself to be. Now, here is an exact relationship between the physical and the psychological that is worth noting. Now, it seems, if you put all of these things together, that it might be conceivable to set up an institution. Let's imagine it's in the mountains or by the ocean. It should be oceanic or cosmic. And this would have small dome, little domes, houses. And a person would come there to prepare to die. I hope you're all not too frightened about this topic for me to be talking about it. Now, you could have as much medical help as you wanted. Right? And furthermore, you could die in whatever religious metaphor you chose. You don't always find a psychedelic rabbi, psychedelic priest, perhaps, psychedelic ministers. There are lots of them. But in addition, when you came into the place, you would be assigned a psychedelic guide. And the whole orientation and approach would be one of dealing with training for how to get free of the ego, which creates so much of the pain and anguish concerned with dying. Now, as an aside, it's interesting to think of who the staff would be, because what you'd need are experienced people who have had many psychedelic sessions, gone in and out of their egos many times. Well, here we might go to the acid test to look for our staff. And indeed, when you think of the youth being what are called fringe members of society, because all they know how to do is to transcend their consciousness, apparently, we have now found a new social institution which employs them. Since I must be economically realistic, I must point out to you that everybody dies. My first experience with psychedelics started me on a journey. And there have been a number of metaphors that I have used along with my colleagues to describe this journey. It seemed to be a journey that concerned increased awareness. Now, I, as a Westerner, had always thought of evolution in terms of Darwinian evolution, and I had thought in terms of biological evolution. And then, as a Westerner further, when I wanted to think of another model of evolution, I could think in terms of the evolving of man's mind. And as we got smarter and smarter, we were getting higher up on some kind of evolutionary scale. But there is yet another kind of evolution, which didn't seem to dawn on me in my sleepwalking state. And that evolution seemed to be one concerning consciousness, that there apparently were some higher states of consciousness. And this first session showed me a glimpse of these higher states and started me on a journey which was quite irrevocable. In fact, it didn't leave me any choice of whether I wanted to be on this journey or not. Because once one saw the possibility of living at any other level of consciousness, which seemed to involve increased awareness, sensitivity, love, unity, it was an interesting person that could turn away. And an Eastern mystic with whom I have been in extensive correspondence has suggested that it is this experience which is addictive. It's not the drug. And I share with him that feeling.